This material, I wrote a book and have done some talks on it, came out of my experience. When I became a Christian at university, started following Jesus when I was in the third year at university, and the next day after I come to Christ, I went to talk to the assistant pastor of the church and said, I'd become a Christian, I thought I needed to spend the rest of my life being a pastor and telling people about Jesus. He wisely suggested I thought about that a bit, so I did a short-term job as a ministry trainee at a church. And the first weekend I was there, the church had a harvest supper. So we went to the church hall, there was a nice meal, and there were kind of like little sketches that people put on, entertainments. It was a really fun evening. At the end of the evening, a group of us guys helped put the staging blocks back up in the loft in the church hall, and then went and did the washing up. I was just leaving to go home, and the pastor took me on one side. He said, John, I just wanted to thank you for your example, just getting stuck in and serving. A lot of the younger guys are encouraged to help because they saw your example. And I thought, this is great. I get to have fun and be commended for it. That's brilliant. I'm going to enjoy this job. And it hadn't occurred to me. I was just enjoying myself with some of the other guys. A few years later, I was assistant pastor at a church in Bolton. And I remember clearly walking up the hill back home from church, Sunday lunchtime, feeling utterly relieved. Because I'd done my duty and the rest of the day was mine. I got through the miserable exhaustion of the two morning services and all the things people wanted to talk to me about and dump onto my plate 2 minutes before I preached. And I was a few smiles and I was free from Jesus. And really what we're doing this weekend is it's all about what went wrong in my heart between Chesham when I was a ministry trainee and Bolton when I was an assistant pastor. What had changed serving Christ from being something I didn't even notice doing because I so delighted to be part of the church to something I hated? See, I am an expert in the sin of weary service. I'm not just a past expert. This isn't a sin I conquered 12 years ago that I'm now going to tell you how to beat. This is something that I struggle with week by week and day by day. I continually fight against being anxious and burdened and worried and carrying the weight of ministry in the church on my shoulders. And I imagine some of you do. Others of you won't identify with this at all. You'll be thinking, well, I just go to church and enjoy it. And if that is you, maybe because you're young, maybe because you're a new Christian, then try to remember, because in a few years' time, this will be you, or that's the danger. Because we tend, as we go on the Christian life, to pick up ways of serving Christ at home, at work, but particularly in the church. And they can become burdensome. And it's a trap. And it's something that the devil uses to squash our love of the Lord. I remember a friend saying to me, I think I have lost my faith underneath the weight of my service at church. Christianity has become to me just pitching up on a Sunday. And he echoed my words, I am relieved when I drive away from church. And I thought, I need to write something about this because it's not just me. And it may be that you are utterly relieved to be sitting here this weekend rather than another weekend of normal church because you get a break. You don't have to preach. You don't have to lead. You don't have to whatever it is you have to do. Now, I've got something for you to think about, particularly you younger people, teenagers, under 11s. Think about your mums, your dads. Think about the people who do your youth work at church, the other adults that you know. And does their service of Christ seem to you a delight? When they get in from doing some service at church, are they delighted by it? Don't answer now, but talk to them about it later. Husbands, when your wives get in from serving Christ at some women's event, are they exhilarated with the wonder of Jesus? Wives, when your men come home from church and they've been busy, are they a joy to be around because of their service of Christ? Or are they grumpy like me? What about your friends? Talk to each other this weekend. Say, look, what John said, I don't see joy in you. Or I do. You clearly love that. I'm hoping there's some of that. But I suspect there'll also be some every time you get back, you seem exhausted. And I think the reason for this is that we serve Jesus wrongly. And I'm going to run through a list of ways I think we serve Jesus wrongly. And it may be that you identify with some of them. It may be you see some of them beginning to grow in your heart. The first is we do it to be good enough for Jesus. He's a great God and we want to be worthy of him. We want to be good enough to be on his team. We don't want to be left against the wall. We want to be picked early. We want to be on his team. We want to be good enough. And we want to live up to who he is. It's a bit silly, really. He's God. He's utterly righteous. But we do that. But maybe that's not you. Maybe you try to earn your salvation. You know that Jesus is great. And you are trying to earn your righteousness. You're trying to earn your goodness from him. And often these things, they show themselves in the negative. So imagine you have sinned in some obvious way. Maybe you went out and you had too much to drink. Luckily, you didn't bump into anyone from church, so no one knows. The next morning, do you just spend a bit longer praying? A bit longer reading your Bible? You're making up for it. You're trying to earn back your righteousness because you know you slipped. It's a bit like when you're in a bad mood and you shout at your wife. Obviously I don't do this. And you shout at your wife. And then you try to be really nice for the next few days to kind of make up. Do you do that with Jesus? Or maybe you want something from him. Maybe you serve Jesus, you work your fingers to the bone in the church because you want something. You want to earn some blessing. And again, it often comes out in the negative. Jesus, I have served you in the children's ministry, in the Sunday school, all these years, and all my friends are married and I'm not. And the bit you don't say is, you owe me. I can identify with this, and it's often much sillier. A Friday evening, and I'm putting the girls to bed, and they are messing around doing their teeth because they're toddlers. And I get furious. They're not being particularly naughty, a little bit naughty. They need a little stern word, but I find myself exerting all my energies not to just shout at them and terrify them. And the reason I'm furious is I have worked hard all week. And there is a pizza in the fridge with a beer next to it and a bad DVD with swords and poor dialogue. And Jesus owes me Friday night. Because I have given him 12-hour days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. He owes me. What does he owe you for your service in church? Does he owe you a child or a husband or fame or a holiday or a helper? Well, maybe it's the other way round for you. Maybe that you think, well, I don't get that at all. Maybe you think, I owe Jesus. He's died for me. So I need to pay him back. I need to repay that enormous debt. He gave his life. What should I not give for him? And that's something that I've used as a pastor to motivate people. You know, we need helpers for the holiday club. Christ died for you. Can't you give him 4 mornings of dressing up as a sponge? It's so silly. When Jesus hung on the cross, he endured hell in our place. He was cut off from God his Father, became not even cursed, but a curse for us. A sinner died the death of a sinner, carrying our sin. He went through an agonizing death, and as he did, God the Father cut him off. He was utterly alone for the first time in eternity. How many cups of tea do you need to make to pay that back? How many holiday clubs? You could go 50 times to the ends of the earth and give your body to be martyred, and you have not even begun to repay one drop of divine blood. And then someone else comes along. I don't know who it is. Whose opinion you care about? Who do you want to know about your service of Christ? Maybe it's Tom, your pastor. Maybe it's the elders. Maybe it's your home group leader. Maybe it's your particular friends at church. Maybe it's that one person who always has a negative comment about your preaching, and one week they're going to say something positive. We so often make our service of Jesus about what other people think of us. You do this at all ages. I guess you guys in the youth group, you have people you look up to. Maybe it's the leaders of the group. Maybe some of you care about what she thinks, about what he thinks. You want to be the one who answers first, or you want to be the one who never answers because you're too cool for school, or whatever it is. You want others to think well of you. And it's just the same for grown-ups. I preach, and I want you to love me. I want you to think I'm great. And I fight that. And part of the reason I fight that is I tell you. Part of the way I do it. I'm always telling church about this sin. They're really bored. Yes, John, we know you're full of pride. You're very wicked. And you only preach for our approval. Can you shut up and preach the Bible? But I do. Now, some people, I was talking to a friend about this. He said that he wants to, when he preaches, he's a preacher as well, when he preaches, he wants people to be impressed with him. In fact, he's surprised when they're not. He knows he is the best preacher on the planet. And he's just amazed when other people don't recognize it. Some people are born to greatness and know it. I'm not like that. With me, I want to belong. So I want people to tell me that I matter. I remember when I was at school, we had a head boy. He was captain of the first 11 cricket team. He was in the first 15 rugby team. He was a straight A-level student. He was handsome. He had a very pretty girlfriend. And he was a really nice guy. You couldn't even hate him. And I remember thinking, I would love to be like that. And I am nothing like that. I want to belong. I want people to tell me that I matter. I'm so keen to be part of the in crowd, part of the people who matter, part of the people who get it right. And you get them in churches, don't you? It's often subtle. There's obvious groups, the elders. But then there's the people who other people listen to. The ones others respect, the ones among your peer group, your age group, who seem to have the ear of the youth group leader or of the elders. Those who are always consulted because they're godly, and you want to be one of them. You want to be part of that group, part of those women who are asked to help with certain things. There's a great line from C.S. Lewis, the guy who wrote the Narnia books. He said, "It is a frightful bore when old Fatty Wigglesworth," I can't remember the name he uses, "asks you to give up your Saturday afternoons to work on the planning group. It is a frightful bore and you grumble about it, but how much worse not to be asked." And we're like that. We want to belong. We want to matter. We want our service to be seen and approved and applauded by those around us. And it's so silly. If your temptation is that you want to be important, then Christ makes you a prince or a princess of heaven. That is more important than being even an elder at Surrey Chapel, even a pastor at Broad Grace. And if it's that you want to belong, if that is what you want other people to tell you that you matter, that you're part of the in crowd, that you belong, then you are drawn into the family of God. When you become a Christian, you are made part of God's family. You are brought within the circle of the Trinity. There is no more in circle than the community of God. See, these things we try to achieve, they are given to us. And it's worth thinking which is you. Are you more tempted to think you're great and ignore what others say and worship yourself? Or are you more tempted to worship what others say? And let them tell you who you are. Because you have to fight pride in different ways, depending on how it hits you. But maybe it's not that. Maybe you just think you're needed. You serve, particularly at church, and your service is needed. Christ needs you. Or at least the church does. Let's look at Luke chapter 10. It's the only thing Jesus got wrong in the Bible. Luke chapter 10, verse 38. I am joking. Luke chapter 10, verse 38. So I'm going to read Luke chapter 10, verse 38 through to the end of the chapter. "As Jesus and his disciples were on their way, he came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. She had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet, listening to what he said. But Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. She came to him and asked him, 'Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do all the work by myself? Tell her to help me.' 'Martha, Martha,' the Lord answered, 'you are worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her.'" I mean, Jesus clearly doesn't have a clue how to run a church, does he? But if you think about it, I don't think I would ask Mary to lead the women's ministry at my church. I don't think Mary is the sort of person you'd get to organise the weekend away. Because she just sits around. Now Martha, if you want something done, ask a busy person. Martha is dependable. She's reliable. She's busy. And I don't know about you, but don't you feel some sympathy for her? I mean, Jesus has pitched up with 12 fishermen types who are hungry. That's 13 at least. Maybe there's more. Maybe there's more around. Maybe some of the women are there. Maybe there's some other guys. But let's assume it's only the 13. 13 unexpected guests arrive at your house. You need to feed them and you need to bed them down. I mean, that is a lot of work, isn't it? You can understand Martha's perspective. No one else is going to do it. It's me and Mary. We need to crack on. And we just so often think like that. Well, there's no one else who's going to lead the youth group session. There's no one else rotated for music this morning. I'm down to preach. Who else is going to make the tea and coffee? Someone needs to clean the building. And it just needs doing. You do it because it needs doing. The thing is that we need to look at it from Jesus' perspective. You can just imagine Martha's thoughts and Christ's replies. We need to get food done. Come on, my fingers are worked to the bone with all this chopping up. Jesus is like, got any loaves? Any fish? It's only 13. Did 5,000 the other day. We need to get the beds ready. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his home. I'm not worried. I'm used to sleeping on, well, resting on light. I'm used to sitting on a throne carved out of rainbows. Whether it's a feather bed or the floor doesn't make a lot of difference. And you can imagine Jesus saying, Martha, you've got God here. You've got God in your sitting room. And you're in the kitchen. And here's Mary. And we don't need to imagine Jesus saying, Martha, you are worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. And the one thing seems to be sitting and listening to Jesus. And I think our churches are full of people who are worried and upset about many things and are running around like headless chickens and are never sitting still and listening to Jesus. And I include myself in that. And I have control of my diary, so I have no excuse. And we run churches on Martha-type service. It's so easy as a pastor. I do it all the time to motivate people with a combination of guilt and encouragement. But you're just so good at preaching. And we just need someone to cover. I need to get a holiday. I'm tired. You wouldn't stop your pastor going on holiday, would you? It's more subtle than that. I just don't know who else will run the PA desk. I just don't know who else could do that. And you know it all. You set it all up. You've been doing it the last 94 years. We need you. I find preemptive guilt quite good. Brilliant job. You've done so well. We couldn't manage without you. And it's not intended, but I do it all the time. And it's a way of motivating people. And we do it to ourselves. I'm always feeling perpetually guilty about the church member who's ill I've not visited, about the prayer I've not done as I scrabble to finish the sermon, about the thinking I've not done as I go to the elders' meeting to talk about our discipleship plan, about the reading I've not done as I encourage my church to read Christian books and grow. I am so glad Jesus died for hypocrites, as well as for other sinners. Or it may be that it has just become a habit. Maybe you used to serve like Martha, and now you just serve because you can't imagine doing anything else. So I come to the weekend, so I better prepare some talks. It can so easily become just a habit. That's what I do. I go to church. I play my guitar. I lead the home group every Wednesday night because I'm a home group leader. And I think that and this is the bit I always hate because I'm afraid it catches me out. if you want to know whether your service of Christ is wrongly motivated and will lead to weariness and burdened exhaustion, then I think the simple test is, do you pray by yourself about it? We all pray with others, because otherwise you look bad. But, you know, do you pray by yourself about your service of Christ? Because you can't get out chairs to the glory of Christ without a work of the Spirit. How much less can you lead people in singing his praises, or lead young people to worship his heart, or to worship him in their heart, or lead your classmates to know Jesus as their Lord and Saviour, or preach to a church without prayer, on your knees, by yourself, to God? And if that is slipping, then your service is slipping into something that is about you. And that destroys us. Because service that is about us, it destroys us when we succeed. It's the terrible, terrible warning of the Pharisees. I don't know if you've ever thought this. The Sadducees are much worse, aren't they? In the Gospels, the Sadducees, they don't believe in angels, they don't believe in the resurrection, they barely believe in God. The Pharisees, they diligently search the Scriptures. Jesus says, John 5, you diligently search the Scriptures, thinking that by them you have life. So why do the Gospel writers tell us so much about how bad the Pharisees are and so little about how bad the Sadducees are? It's because they know we'll become Pharisees. They know where our danger lies. We're not those who are in danger of going, I'm not sure Jesus actually rose. Maybe it was all a metaphor for spirit. We don't do that. We believe in the Bible. We know God wrote it. We know it is his word. That isn't our danger. No, our danger is the danger of the Pharisees. Luke 11:43, woe to you Pharisees, because you love the most important seats in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces. They knew they mattered to God because people told them so. Sit here. We've got a chair for you, Rabbi. Ah, Rabbi Benjamin. He's a godly man. You should have heard his sermon last Saturday. They knew they mattered to God because people told them so. They were proud. Our service destroys us because it makes us proud. Or more often, it destroys us because we fail. Even Elijah, when he had defeated the prophets of Baal on the top of the mountain, and the Lord had brought down fire, and he expected Israel to turn back to the Lord in revival, and instead Jezebel sends him a message saying, you're going to be dead by the end of the day. And he realizes the revival won't happen, and that for all his ministry and his service of the Lord, and he stands before the Lord and he says, I have been so faithful and nothing has happened. And the Lord goes, actually, it's not about you, Elijah. I have 7,000 who haven't bowed the knee to Baal. It's not about you, Elijah. Of course, your work will not bring Israel back to me. That's my job. And in fact, I want you to go and anoint Elisha. He's going to carry on the work instead. Elijah, well, he wasn't destroyed because the Lord is faithful. And the thing is, we will always fail. We will always not do enough. There's always more to do. There's always stuff we're missing. There's always someone else we ought to be talking to, someone we ought to be praying for, something else we should be doing. We will never do enough to pay Jesus back, to earn his love. That is why the Pharisees were so judgmental. Because rather than look at themselves, it's much easier to look at others and go, I'm better than him, I'm better than her, I'm better than him, I'm certainly better than her. It was much, much easier. And we do this. I look around and I think, oh yes, more godly than him, better preacher than him. I'm not a better preacher than him and less godly, but I'm taller than him, so that's better. And you judge people. It can become almost a sport for Christians in our little groups or by ourselves or in our marriages. We talk about others and we tut about their judgmentalism, or we tut about their sin, or we tut about their child rearing, and we make ourselves feel important, like we matter, like we get it right, like we're the righteous ones, like our service of Christ is important. We judge and we hide ourselves away because if they knew, they wouldn't listen to a word I said. We hide ourselves and we judge others and we cut ourselves off from relationship because we know that our service of Christ isn't enough. And it doesn't make us what we want it to make us. And even worse than destroying us, the way we serve Jesus denies Jesus. It is a wicked sin. It makes it about me. Every time I get up to preach, I am tempted to rob Christ of the glory that is his and make it mine. I am always tempted to preach John, not Jesus, and to leave you worshipping me. And that's what our service does. When it's about me being great, when it's about me earning, so when it's about me and what you think of me, it stops being about Jesus. You get it, the result in Mark 7. Mark 7 verses 6 to 8. Mark 7, verses 6 to 8, Jesus is talking to the Pharisees. He replied, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you, hypocrites. As it is written, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are but rules taught by men. You have let go of the commands of God and are holding on to the traditions of men." You see, our service of Christ becomes our slavery to sin. And this is the thing that I think opened my eyes to how wicked I was. It was reading the beginning of a commentary on the book of Romans by Martin Luther, the German monk who became a Christian in the 16th century. And he just gently pulled, well, not gently, Luther doesn't do anything gently, but he pulled out of Paul's teaching in Romans that anything that doesn't flow from faith is sin. So anything that doesn't flow from our love of God is sin. And I used to think of sin quite externally, which is a bit of a silly thing to do, but I did. Not about my heart. And reading that short article by Luther made me realize that I could preach and it be sin. I could go to the prayer meeting because I wanted to impress the pastor, and that would be sin because it did not proceed from love of God. And anything that doesn't proceed from love of God is sin. And it turned my world upside down. It meant that it was possible for it to be godly not to go to youth group, but to stay at home and play Xbox because you're enjoying your freedom in Christ. So if you think Jesus has set me free, I don't have to go to the Bible study at youth group. I can stay at home and play my Xbox because I'm saved by his blood, not by my attendance. That can be done out of the love of God. Or you can go to youth group because you think you ought to, because your mum and dad tell you, and because you want your mates to think you're a good Christian. And that's sin. And I always just used to think if you did the right thing, it was right. And if you didn't, and we go, well, yeah, but if you go, then you'll hear the Bible and God might use that to open your eyes. And how many times have we done the right thing for the wrong motives and the Lord has used that? Well, yes, but should we sin that grace may abound? He does. He's gracious. He's good. He's kind. He often opens us to joy and delight in him when we do the right thing for the wrong motives. But they're still the wrong motives. We turn serving Christ into an external thing. It's about what you do. And it's so easy to do this to yourself or to others. So easy for me to say when I know times are hard and things are tricky to the elder who's not made the last couple of elders meetings. Look, it's just really important we all meet together. It's just some important decisions. You know, you committed to this. Those things are true and right. But you end up motivating someone to service by guilt, not by love. And Jesus doesn't do that. And where this ends up is it ends up being weary and exhausting. Because it's not about Christ, so it's not about connecting us with the one who is the fountain of life. Because it's about me, it ends up being weary and exhausting. It kills our faith and it puts others off. I don't know what you think about the Jehovah's Witnesses as they go door to door on a Saturday morning. You probably think you wish they wouldn't knock. But maybe you admire them a bit. I mean, they are committed, aren't they? But I always think, I wouldn't want to be one of them. Because then I'd have to go door to door on a Saturday morning looking as depressed as they do. And I don't want to do that. I've got better things to do on a Saturday morning. And I just wonder if sometimes people think that of us. A friend of mine said recently he's realised he needs to stop saying how tired he is because his toddler son keeps saying, "Oh, I'm so tired." And what do our friends hear? What do they hear of service of Christ? Someone once commented, I think it was my wife, Flick, that it was weird because Christians all had diaries because they were so busy and no one else had diaries. And that most people who wanted to meet up, they'd meet for a drink after work that day. Whereas Christians needed to book it in 3 weeks ahead because they were so busy. What impression do we give? And what I'd love you to think about this weekend is stopping. Just stop it, will you? We need to stop serving Jesus like this. And that might mean stopping an area of service. In church, in wider life. Because if your service of Christ is killing your faith, at some point, you and your service will die. So better for your service to die and you to live. Now, obviously don't just ditch it now, right? See, I'm not leading the children's work next session. Obviously there's ways of doing that are right, that allow for change and for gradual transition. But why not? And if you can't imagine stopping a particular way of serving Christ, or all the ways you particularly serve Christ, if you can't imagine it, then you are in trouble. It might not be that you need to stop, but if you can't imagine stopping, then I think that is a bad sign. You see, if Jesus needs me to be the pastor of Broad Grace, then he is not God. He is not Lord, he is not King, and he is not sovereign. It is that simple. If he needs me, he isn't who he says he is. Jesus managed before you were on the PA desk. Jesus built his church before any of us were born, and unless the Father sends him back, he will build it after we are all dead. And nothing matters that much. And this is hard. I struggle with this. We're a small church. All our musicians are mums with young babies. And it means that, well, we decided that we would rather have musicians leading the worship who are worshipping God in their hearts than exhausted musicians doing it because there was no one else. So we often don't sing when we meet as a church. And we miss it. But I just didn't want to pressure our musicians into playing every week because I felt it would be bad for them. I knew it would be bad for them. And it was hard, and I had to kind of swallow. And visitors always come on the weeks with no music. And it is hard, but I figure Jesus is the Lord of broad grace, not me. And if he wanted us to have music, he could move Stuart Town into North Norfolk. He has a lot of musicians. If it mattered to him, he would fix it. It's not up to me to fix it because I can't move people's hearts to do it through joy and love. Now, we're going to rebuild what I've just been tearing down over the weekend because, of course, there is a way to serve Christ that is full of life and joy. And that's where we're heading. But what I want us to stop on now is the thought that maybe Jesus doesn't want a children's ministry if it is a weary, exhausted children's ministry. Maybe he wants your heart more than he wants your hands. Maybe he loves you more than he loves your evangelism. And I'd love you to pray about this today. And giving something up may help. It may even be necessary for you. But it is not the answer. It may be a way you can take hold of the answer. But the answer is in Mark chapter 10, verse 45. This is where we're going to finish our first session. And it's where we're going to pick up for our second session. Mark chapter 10, verse 45. I'll read from verse 35 so you get the situation that Jesus speaks it into. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. What do you want me to do for you? He asked. They replied, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. They're the kinds who want to be great. You don't know what you are asking. Clearly they don't, because one of them is asking to be God the Father. Jesus said, can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? We can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared, probably me. When the ten heard about this, they became indignant with James and John because they wanted to sit there. Jesus called them together and said, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. Whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. And we often fix on those verses and say, yes, we must serve Christ, and we must, and they are true. But look where Jesus lands. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. And the thought we are going to go into coffee in a couple of minutes after a little bit of discussion is this. We are not servants of Jesus. We are served by Jesus. That is his glory. We are not primarily those who serve. We are those who are served. If we did nothing, if I resigned as a pastor today and went and took up surfing and smoking weed on the Cornish coast and never read my Bible or prayed but hung on to Christ, I would be as much his as I am today, because he serves us, and that is what defines us. I am not John, the pastor of Broad Grace. I am John by the grace of God, his. That's it.